The Office for the Privacy Commission is cracking down on property managers and landlords who risk breaching the Privacy Act in the way they handle tenants' personal information. Renters groups call the industry a wild west with little regulation or oversight for how property managers and landlords conduct their business. They describe the invasive process of applying for flats, being asked to provide information about race, gender, sexual orientation or political affiliations, or required to submit bank statements to show spending habits. Tenants' information is also still being submitted to online databases or bad tenant groups online, effectively blacklisting some people from rentals. However, they frequently contain inaccurate or incomplete information and lack transparency, advocates say. In a moment, we'll speak with the Deputy Privacy Commissioner, Liz McPherson, about the guidelines the Commission's introduced for landlords and property managers. But first, Ashok Jacob is spokesperson for Renters United. Kia ora, Ashok, welcome.
Kia ora, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
So I'm sure there's a great variation in relationships between landlords and tenants, but what are some of the worst things you see when it comes to landlords invading renters' privacy?
Well, we hear all sorts of things from our members all over the country. We made a survey and made a report last year to help the Office of the Privacy Commission draft these guidelines, and we had people reporting, like, you know, the usual sort of things that breach the Human Rights Act, like asking about sexual orientation, gender identity, race, ethnicity, religion. But we also had people being asked things that are a bit more complicated but no less insipid, like whether or not they had any friends or family members who were affiliated with gangs, whether or not they intend to have children as well, is a really big one, which is like really personal and private information, but is quite common to be collected by landlords and property managers when people apply for their property.
Do they ask these things in writing, in person, both?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a mix of both. I mean, I don't know if one's better than the other. I mean, in writing, certainly easier to sort of crack down upon. But a lot of people, especially like smaller landlords and smaller property management companies who have more of a direct personal relation with their tenants, will ask questions like this in person. And if you're being asked something like that by somebody who has power over you like that, it's really difficult to say no.
The reason I ask about in writing is because there are forms provided, and again, this comes back between the difference between good practice and bad practice. There are forms, pre-tenancy forms supplied by government agencies for people to fill out. But do some of these people sort of have their own forms with these questions in writing?
Yeah, I mean, the ones that are on tenancy services are just guidelines, right? I mean, a lot of property management companies will have legal teams that draft up their own forms, or they'll just do what they think they can get away with. I mean, New Zealand is uniquely unregulated when it comes to the rental market. And so there's this real culture of like people, property managers and landlords, just doing what they think that they won't get caught doing, no matter whether or not it's legal.
The bad tenants, so-called bad tenants social media groups, I thought they got cracked down on. Can you explain first what their legal status is? We'll ask the Privacy Commission about it more in a moment. But what happened with them? Because there was a lot of noise around them.
Yeah, there was a lot of noise last year about the bad tenant groups on Facebook and on social media, which is something that the OPC actually did clamp down on last year. And I was really glad to be a part of that, and I was really happy to see that. But there are still companies out there that maintain lists of tenants for property managers and landlords to use, and some of them, you know, may be operating legally and have good legal teams that make sure that they're operating within the bounds of the law. But this is still something that people need to be aware of, because these companies do have responsibilities to make sure that the information they keep on you is accurate and that you're available, you're able to see what sort of things that they have on you.
So do they operate similarly?
Really need to be aware of.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt you, Ashok. Do they operate similarly to the way a credit agency company might operate, where it will keep sensitive details, but where a member of the public does have the right to challenge the facts, which can have quite some impact? Do some of these companies operate similarly?
Yeah, when they're operating within the law, that is the sort of the model that they're based on, yeah.
But there are others not operating within the law, as far as you're concerned.
Well, I mean, I would have questions, to be honest.
Other issues that have been raised surround flat inspections, and particularly during the complications of COVID, where in-person inspections have been more difficult. What are some of the things that you're being told?
Yeah, this is something that's been really difficult over the past few months. Certainly, people, especially around the, now with the vaccination rollout, a lot of people who are concerned about having vaccinated or people who are concerned about having unvaccinated people come into their property, be it for property viewings or flat inspections or something like that. And this is something that the Tenancy Tribunal and these regulatory bodies have had to sort of set up on the fly. And so there's a lot of like there's some teething pains, there's some growing pains. When it comes to actually like establishing what the norms of around this sort of thing should be. And so we're hearing a lot of people who have concerns about their landlords coming around without, you know, using proper COVID guidelines or without who are even landlords who are potentially unvaccinated and their tenants are, and they're not comfortable with those people, coming into their property unannounced, essentially. So yeah, that's something that we've been seeing.
But the use of video or even Zoom was also causing some agitation.
Yeah, that's true, and I think as far if I remember correctly, I think there was a guideline put out by Tenancy Services saying that you don't have to consent to a virtual property inspection. Although this is something that's been happening for some time, especially the larger property management companies, when they send out their inspectors, they will just send out somebody with a phone and they'll take video of the flat and then either they'll take it back to review it or just keep it for record keeping, which is something that we're also really aware of.
Can we talk about this issue of what can and can't be asked with respect to income? Is there an ability to seek some information about, I guess, ability to pay the rent and keep paying the rent and paying the bond and everything else? Or are there absolutely limits on what landlords can ask?
I mean, there are limits. And I think that the idea behind this is that it has to be conducted in good faith, right? I mean, we had there's a real issue, especially a few years back, with property management companies and landlords asking people to provide bank statements and like statements of like transactions and purchases and stuff. And there was actually like one property management company that referred to it as the KFC test to make sure that the potential tenants weren't spending frivolously, which is really over the line and is actually against the previous guidelines that had been put out by the OPC and the But the new guidelines that have come out are much more stringent and much more able to be enforced. So I'm pretty glad to see those.
Is there also a loophole, however, because as I understand it, landlords can't ask if a tenant is receiving a benefit, but they can ask for proof of income? Now, wouldn't that reveal whether someone's receiving a benefit?
Yeah, that is a loophole, and it's something that that people have come forward about before. But again, as I said, the real like impetus is on the landlord to be acting in good faith. And if you're using the proof of income to determine whether or not your tenant is on a benefit, then that really puts up questions as to what you're using that information for, and there have been tenancy tribunal cases around this. So yeah, it really is a tricky situation.
What are the means of enforcement, Ashok? And we'll talk more, as I said, in a moment to the Office of the Privacy Commission. But what are the means of enforcement that actually result in changed behaviour? It would be nice if it wasn't enforcement that resulted in changed behaviour. But in these most egregious examples, that seems what's necessary. Is there enough teeth to give effect to the principles or to the guidelines?
I mean, I'm hopeful. I think it's a lot better than it was, because before the new Privacy Act, the Privacy Act 2020 came into force, and I'm sure Liz will talk about this more in a second, but like before that new act came in, that the Office of the Privacy Commissioner only had the power to investigate after a complaint had been made. But now they have they have more of a remit to do more of an active investigation and enforcement. And they have the ability to send like letters to people saying, you know, sort of a cease and desist type thing. And then, you know, if there's continued breaches, they have more of an enforcement capability, which is which is hopefully something we're going to be seeing more of. And as I said before, I'm hopeful that this will result in more positive change.
Ashok, thank you. Ashok Jacobs, spokesperson for Renters United. Liz McPherson is the Deputy Privacy Commissioner. Kia ora, Liz.
Kia ora, Catherine. Kia ora, Ashok.
Kia ora.
Can you explain what changes have happened already since 2020, Liz?
Since 2020?
Go ahead.
So in November of, well, as Ashok indicated, last year we undertook some work to look into the rental sector. Now, this wasn't because we'd received complaints to us. This was because of the noise we were hearing in the system. And as Ashok said, with the new Privacy Act, we don't have to wait to receive complaints. We can actually have a look under the hood, so to speak, and see what we can find. So we did that, and we worked with Renters United and other rental advocacy groups. We worked with landlords, with property managers, with property investors groups, and people were very constructive and provided us with information. But basically, the conclusion that we reached was that there was over-collection going on, and there was the need for us to put in place some even clearer guidelines about what could be collected. And I guess the key message is about right information, right time, and in the right way. So we've issued some new guidance, and we've indicated to the rental sector that we will be undertaking compliance action in a month, in March. We gave them 3 months to get their application forms and other things in shape, and we'll be starting compliance action from then.
So what's in and what's out when it comes to what they can ask?
Right. Well, I'll start with what a landlord should never collect. And Ashok has already covered some of these things. So when you're selecting a tenant, completely off is personal characteristics that are protected under the Human Rights Act. So sex, including pregnancy or childbirth, relationship or family status, political opinion or religious or ethical belief, colour, race, ethnicity, physical or mental disability or illness, age, other than whether the tenant is over 18, employment status, sexual orientation or gender identity. Also, we've clarified that whether a tenant has experienced or experiencing family violence is not something that can be asked. A tenant's spending habits, their bank statements showing transactions, and also something that was being asked quite frequently, and we talked with Ashok and others about, is social media URLs.
Right, although many can Google, but that's up to the prospective tenant, isn't it, as it is in any situation. What rights does the landlord have to ascertain whether someone can keep up rental payments?
Well, I think the key thing to remember is that you need to be, when you're collecting information from a tenant, you need to be collecting it for a purpose. So we've carefully in our guidance divided we've talked about the right time for collecting things. So the sort of information you collect when a person is viewing a property should be just name and contact information only, i.e. so that you can follow them up after a viewing. When somebody is applying for a tenancy, that's when you're able to start getting into that information that allows you to see whether they'll be a suitable tenant, and selecting the preferred applicants. So more information can be collected at that stage.
What can you ask at that stage?
At that stage, again, name and contact information. You can ask for proof of identity, whether the applicant is aged 18 or over. You can ask about the number of people who would live at the property, the names only of the occupants who will not be on the tenancy agreement, but not other personal details about non-tenants. You can ask for contact details for landlords and non-landlord references, consent to contact referees, and you can contact them at that stage. You can ask for consent for a credit report and criminal record check, but you can only actually take that out if the person becomes a preferred applicant. And you can ask about pet ownership only if there is a restriction on the pets being allowed at the property. Whether occupants are smokers, if there are, again, restrictions on the property, and whether the tenant has a legal right to remain in New Zealand for the duration of the tenancy. And that's only if the tenancy is for a fixed term.
So what you can do is get specific about things like pets or smoking, for example, and in fact the number of people allowed to live at the house at the point you're a preferred tenant and we're about to sign. But I asked about ability to pay rent. And
So actually, Catherine, that's what you can ask for when the person's actually applying for the tenancy.
Right.
Then you go to the next stage, which is when somebody's actually a preferred applicant. So this is, if you think about it like you're applying for a job, you've got down to the very final shortlist, right? Now that's when you can ask for information about ability to pay. So ability to pay rent, in addition to a credit report, you can ask for things like a pay slip, a letter from an employer, or work and income, evidence of rental payments in a previous tenancy. And in fact, you may have already got that when you spoke, if you took out a reference from a previous landlord. If they essentially said, look, this person always paid their rent on time, then, you know, that would be of help to you. But again, you can't ask for evidence of tenant spending habits such as detailed bank statements.
So where we've got to is you can't go on fishing expeditions early in the process for everyone who turns up to view. You can get more and more specific when you're at the point of making an offer. Okay. Can I get your take on inspections? Because for many landlords, their insurers will require regular inspections of the property. They do need some evidence they've done it, right? So what's okay and what's not when it comes to inspections?
Well, again, you have to focus on why you're doing this. And, you know, a range of personal information can be collected during the tenancy, for example, photos and notes from flat inspections. But the key thing, again, focusing on the personal information, is that the photo should provide no more information than is necessary to document how the tenants are looking after the property.
It should be photos of carpet and windows and showers, not of anything personal.
Absolutely. They must not intrude unreasonably into the tenant's personal affairs. For example, photos shouldn't be focusing on personal items.
When it comes to the storage and sharing of that information, what is the law around these websites, Facebook groups, for example, the so-called bad tenants groups?
Well, essentially, if information is being held about you, you should have access to it. Now, as Ashok said, there tend to be two different approaches to this. One is where you've got property management information brokers who hold information or about somebody's, for example, they may have actually broken their bond or something like that, and that information is held. Any information that is held about you, you need to have access to. You have the right to ask for access to that information. These so-called bad tenants sites. We worked with Facebook actually to help close down one of them. If anyone knows about these, again, we would like to know ourselves. We have a tip line that we've developed, and we can work with Facebook if it is an admin site. Where a service is effectively being provided. And again, the individual themselves has the ability to ask for access to that information to ensure that it's correct.
You mentioned that you're going to start enforcement in a month's time. What might enforcement look like?
Well, one of the things that we did, Catherine, when we released the guidance in November, we announced that we were going to be taking this action, and we released our compliance strategy at the same time, because we wanted the sector to know the approach that we're taking. And we designed this compliance strategy specifically for the rental sector, because we know that with the imbalance in power in the market at the moment, caused by supply and demand issues, tenants don't tend to complain to us. They can, and we encourage them to, but we do know that they can be concerned that this could damage their chances. So we've got a variety of different approaches that we're taking. Proactively, from the 1st of March, we will be looking at tenancy application forms to make sure that they're compliant with the Privacy Act. We will also be looking at tenancy agreement forms again to make sure they're compliant. And we'll also be looking at privacy policies and statements that these landlords and property management companies have. We'll be looking at their websites. We'll also be asking for copies if they're not on their websites. We'll be starting with the big end of town, but we'll also look at some smaller landlords as well.
You can issue compliance notices, can you not? Can you issue that to anybody if you have inquired? And what do they involve?
Well, what they involve is, and I can say now that because we've worked with the sector for so long now, and they have been and been constructive and have been changing their behaviour, if we find issues, we will be sending them what is called a compliance notice. It starts off by being a draft compliance notice. We're required to do this under law, which allows the company to comment. We can make specifications in that compliance notice. If the company does not, or agency doesn't comply, we will then issue them with a final compliance notice, give them some time to take action. If they don't take action within that time, we would prosecute. And there is the up to $10,000 fine.
We've got some questions. People want to know how long after you've left your tenancy that an owner or a landlord can hold on to your personal details.
There are requirements under the Residential Tenancy Act, but essentially it's purpose driven. It's for no longer than is necessary under that legal framework.
On the question of vaccinations, Ashok raised this and mentioned people uncomfortable about an unvaxxed landlord coming on site. It's obviously a very contemporary issue, but what does the law say about someone's rights?
Well, again, it is a very contemporary issue. The guidance that we've been providing is that it's important, as Ashok was saying earlier, it's about the relationship between the landlord or the property manager and the tenant. If the tenant is concerned about somebody who's unvaccinated coming onto the property, then arrangements can be made to either ensure that, for example, either the landlord or the tradespeople who are doing work on the site, for example, or doing inspections are vaccinated, or alternatively to make arrangements that those people visit the property when the tenant is not there. These arrangements can be made.
So it should be cooperation, right? On the question of being able to discriminate on the basis of a tenant being unvaccinated, this question is coming in as well. Again, a very contemporary issue, but is that a ground to discriminate?
Again, it comes down to whether there's actually a legal purpose here. For example, in the workplace, if you had a workplace that had a vaccination mandate in place, then the employer is within their rights to ask an employee if they are vaccinated, and the employee needs to respond. If there wasn't a vaccination mandate in place, then that in the workplace, the employer could ask and the individual could refuse to answer, and on that basis the employer could decide that that individual was not unvaccinated and behave accordingly. But I guess the key thing here, Catherine, is what is the purpose? In some places where you have properties where you have a number of people living in the one place, like a multiple tenancy, there may well be the need to ask about vaccination status.
Right, so if there were a number of flats together, say, and perhaps some, you know, compromised people, your point is the principle is there has to be a purpose for the discrimination. Mm. I'm going to throw you a curveball just to finish. I want to come back and talk about this another time, possibly. You've been talking about tenants' rights not to have landlords going through their KFC purchase habits. Are you comfortable with what's going on with the banks at the moment in response to the new Credit and Consumer Finance Act legislation and the details to which they are perusing people's personal habits? Because some of the banks are uncomfortable about it.
We've obviously been keeping an eye on this one, Catherine, since it broke in the media. And we're engaging with our partner agencies about what is in fact going on here. I mean, certainly what we've heard in the media sounds like there are some privacy intrusive inquiries, but we understand that the minister has asked for a review of the way this is working. I'd have to say we were somewhat surprised, given that the CCCFA regulations, in our understanding, were intended to have a limited application and a focus on high credit, cost credit, and predatory lending. And so some of the anecdotes are concerning, but we've been in contact with our colleague regulators and offered our assistance, and we'll be monitoring this.
Thank you, Liz McPherson's Deputy Privacy Commissioner. Thanks also to Ashok Jacob of Renters United.